Thank you, Andrew, and welcome everyone to a day full of showers. I hope you had one when you got up. You got one while you were traveling here, and you're bound to have one when you're going home as well. So we're a very clean audience. It's my great pleasure to introduce Irene Macara McWilliam. We've met briefly once before, and I'm very excited to hear her lecture, which you know the title of from the pieces of paper, but it is called Creative Communities, Design, Technology, and Well-being. Irene.
Thank you very much. Good evening, everybody. My intention tonight is to describe creative communities, I'll define in a minute, in relation to technology and well-being through the lens, if you like, of design. So the subject is design. And I'm going to show you my work in that area, some of the things that are going on in the Glasgow School of Art, and the intention is at the end of it that we're going to discuss some of the issues that we might take forward in a workshop in January. So the intention is, as you're looking at this, you can agree or disagree, you can look at some of the examples, but perhaps just in the back of your mind, if you want to discuss something, I'll answer some questions and points at the end, but if you would like to really lock in together to take some of the ideas forward, then there'll be an opportunity to do so. Because of that, I've put this together as quite a broad brushstroke presentation to give some ideas and flavours around the subjects that have been introduced here. And I'll go at quite a cracking pace for two reasons. One, that there's quite a lot to cover. But the second is, I've just learned with this Mac, there is a power save on it, so it's going to cut off every so often, unless I really push the button through the slides. So if I talk too much, it'll switch off, and if I don't talk fast enough, it will have the same effect. So, subject matter is design. One of the things that I'd like to propose to you is design makes thinking visible. That's just, I take that as a statement of fact. The reason that design is so powerful strategically in business, especially now in the creative economy, we've had the Cox Review, we're looking for more integration of design with business, is design language is visual language, it's highly communicable. It's participatory, it invites feedback. So we make our thinking and thinking in general visible. That means people can respond to it. They can agree or disagree and so on. But at least it is highly communicative. So design is a tool for thinking in the presentation of ideas, and abstract ideas as well as very concrete ones is very strong. So for example, this logo, you could call it, or image, was used in Philips to promote connected services and connected technology. So you can see the images of the one world with all of the different people in it with different types of technology. So it's obvious what the content is, but you can see it in a very elegant way in an image. And similarly with this one, here's a picture that could represent different cultures. It could represent networked technology like internet that works down into the local level. So I can use this for a discussion on design for technology. And of course, we can draw these things in quite different ways, in many different ways. This is one representation. So that introduction is just meant to communicate that the picture can sometimes not only tell more than 1,000 words, but it invites interpretation and response. So that's why I think design is increasingly being used strategically as a tool. So, here's my subject for the evening. You've heard about this. And just to give you some background about why I'm talking to you about these subjects, I'm a psychologist by training, but I worked in medical research for a number of years in the fields of biomedical physics and bioengineering, and also in medical sociology, and then went into computer systems design. So my place of design, I came to design by trying to make those technologies understandable to people. And that's what design is about. So we as designers, the design community, occupy a ground which synthesizes different types of knowledge, technology or cultural knowledge in order to make it understandable for other groups of people, users, consumers, communities, whatever. So in retrospect, my career makes sense, I always say. So I've worked in Philips as a director of design research, and I was in the company for about 17 years and then came back to the UK 3 or 4 years ago to work at the Royal College of Art. And then last year I came to Glasgow, so back to Scotland after 20 years. So my fields of expertise are in the areas of technology and psychology folded into design. So today, the subject is the imagination, and I'm really going to describe that in two ways. The imagination in terms of the mundane, what I call the mundane imagination, and the creative imagination. And I'm going to show you how to differentiate between the two, and why our focus in design or creative synthesis is on the creative imagination. So I'm going to go through my definition of these areas together with you. So the mundane imagination is something that we use all the time when we plan. If we want to... Planning. If you're deciding where you want to go for your holiday, what you're going to have for your tea tonight, what your shopping list is at Tesco's, anything that involves forward planning, you're using the mundane imagination, which is not so mundane, it's highly complex. But we use it to imagine the things that we're going to do. Imagine what we'd like to eat. Imagine the beer that we're going to drink in the pub, whatever. That's the mundane imagination. The creative imagination is about synthesis, as I said, of different knowledges, and that has a psychological, if you like, a neurological aspect. It's when we put things together in novel ways, new ways. So here's a few mundane assumptions that might be provocative, but it's good to start in a very black and white way, and we can move into some middle ground later, or we can even argue about these different positions. But this is my position. A lot of forecasting and research, which is about the future, is actually based on the mundane level and not at the creative level. So we make assumptions about the future, such as it can be extrapolated from what we know today, and there's simply going to be a lot more of it. It's a bit like today, but a bit more of it. Today's trends are known. We can add in and bump them up into a roadmap into the future, so it's a probability waiting to happen. If we accept that as a starting point, there is no creative imagination needed, you could say, to allow that future to happen. It's going to happen almost in spite of us. And in a sense, politically, that's certain of the big problems that we have in the world, such as climate change, almost feels as if they're being discussed in those terms. They're things waiting to happen. But of course, our role is intervention in imagining what the world would be like if certain things did not happen or if other things were encouraged. So here's a few mundane assumptions. Globalization, individualization, the information society, mass customization, aging population. The last one is, of course, the one that I personally take most exception to as a phrase, because we're all aging from the moment we're born. And the triumph of medicine that we live a bit longer is now, in a sense, being described as a problem that we have to deal with. So these things are obviously there and they're happening. But the point is, the actual local context is always very nuanced, very complex. So we need to contextualize all of these trends into our local situation and perhaps even employ some alternatives. So if we say globalization and individualization, I say, where is community? If businesses mass customize for the individual what has become known as the market of one, there are even books on this subject, then it is highly individualized, targeted marketing right down to the individual customer. Now, some people may say and propose that this is a very good thing because we satisfy all our needs and desires. But the question then becomes a value-based one on what kind of society you want to create in the future if our job is to satisfy individual needs and desires on the fly, as it were, or whether we are looking at different values. So here are some of the trends that all of you will be familiar with, and I'm just saying we should stop and question some of these because there is always a value behind them. So that's my question, and when we look at these different aspects, what about the values, the value of experience rather than aging? We can look at how can people make a contribution and in what ways as they change careers or retire or develop as they get older. How can we imagine people having multiple lifetimes and not just one? So we can use these new kind of facts or trends much more creatively than tends to be the case. So here are some of the things I think that you in this audience, you might identify with. We have concern about our material culture, the value of experience, creativity, craft and the arts, the form that things take in our societies, the appreciation of the environment. So if we're going to design a future, we can design that vision based on values. And so the values for me are the starting point of the articulation of the design process. So if we want to improve communities, regenerate parts of a city, improve our health services, then we are setting up, first and foremost, a subscription within a team to a set of values which will be articulated. So that's the mundane imagination, and now we look at the creative imagination, and that in turn has two aspects. This was first of all defined actually very clearly by Samuel Taylor Coleridge, the poet, Kubla Khan, the poem we read at school. He, in his philosophical writings, spoke a lot about the imagination, and he defined these two ways, which I think are quite interesting. And one is the imagination's involvement in perception, which he called the primary imagination, and then the synthesis, the creative leap into novelty. And what he was basically saying with perception is, and as a psychologist, we could go into this quite a lot, person, your interests and your experience, your motivation, your intentions help define the world that you see. You're not a passive receptor of data which somehow gets processed in the place that we call the mind or the brain. You actively see the world. So if I were to say to you, look round the room and look and see who is wearing red shoes, I am basically programming your perception to be able to do that. If we all walked down Sauchie Hall Street with a different motivation, we would see different things. A homeless person would see Sauchie Hall Street in a different way from a policeman, from a shopper, from a student, from a single mum, and so on. Perception is active, that's really what I'm saying. And that's quite interesting because in teaching students and designers, one of the things we teach is how well can you see the world? And most importantly, can you see it or feel it through somebody else's eyes? And that's called empathy. I think we all feel it if we are involved with somebody who's going through a hard time or suffering. We can feel empathy for other people. And it's imaginatively putting ourselves in somebody else's shoes. And that is a sensibility, let's say, that has to be developed in design. Empathy. So primary imagination, perception and empathy, secondary imagination, inspiration, the creative leap, and synthesizing knowledge and experience together. So if we put them in a little diagram, past and present, mundane, creative, we can start to play with it. This is usually where most people are keen to explore the creative future, we could call it. What's going to be happening? What can we do? What can we make as a company, as a university? How can we project into the future and design for a circumstance that is not here yet? This is usually what happens, and again I'm simplifying perhaps the story, but in order to make the point. People start with the mundane imagination, the mundane trends which have been proposed, not much reflection on the past, which is a huge store of inspiration in my experience, and project it bigger into the future. So I'll show you some examples of that, of where I think I've seen it happening. So we end up with a bigger future, as I described earlier, a bit like today, the global trends, but kind of more worrying, bigger. You know, we should be scared. Something like this. Or it's going to happen anyway, whatever we do. Surveillance society. There's one. It's happening. I don't disagree. There's more CCTVs than ever before. We have reasons to be worried about surveillance. I think we all know about how information is tracked and so on. But we don't have to extrapolate it unless we accept that we are passive in responding to these things, that this is going to be the kind of place we're going to be living in. So there's the country house with all of the CCTVs around it. And that we set up villages, which is a proposal I've seen and is actually happening, where you have gated villages in the country, very expensive, of course, which are beautifully landscaped, and a lot of surveillance cameras round about them. So you could pay to have this kind of future, and some of it is in the present now. And again, I say, if we work in a values-based vision, my question is, here is design asking a question, and the question is this where you want to live? Is this the future we want to create? Is this going to be the suburbs of Glasgow? Is it going to be like this? And if it is, the centre of the cities will look like this. And this is research undertaken by government in the context of this kind of thinking that says if more people move to the suburbs because the centre gets more deprived or violent or whatever, unpleasant in certain ways, then the animals take over. I'm parodying it slightly, of course, but this then, we move to the country and the animals move into the city, to make it very black and white. So again, if this is even a possibility, the question is it what we want? So again, a visual image not actually being used to say this is the future and this is realistic, but because it makes it edgy and provocative, it can ask the question, because there is a certain amount of truth in this that I think we all recognise. The smart home. This is the home of the future. And this is what it looks like. So you can imagine that your home, if it's not already, will be this clean. And there are no pets. There's no shoeboxes under the bed. There's no newspaper lying around. There's nothing much apart from some screens and somebody looking at some content using a remote control. And these kinds of images we're all familiar with as well, the smart home, the intelligent home, and so on, that looks like nobody's home. So I sometimes wonder how much research goes on to look at real homes, real people, and so on, when this can be extrapolated, that everybody's going to become very tidy suddenly, 5 years from now or whenever. So that's why when we look at this, we can say, do we accept it? This looks like a laboratory to me, except it's pink and not white. So do we accept it, that this is a kind of technocratic vision of the future, or do we question the values here? So if we do use design again as a tool for thinking and imagining and letting people narrate their own lives, then we also as designers design tools to do so. So I've talked about design as visualization, design as asking questions, and now I'm going to talk about design tools that help us see the world from other people's points of view. So then we're looking at the creative imagination and perception to the place that where we want to be. And I would propose to you that the place we start is today. All design is located in the present. Obviously. And what we need to do, I propose, is look at the present very, very carefully, with that fresh vision that Coleridge talked about. So when I ask a student, if you walk along Sauchie Hall Street, what do you see? How well do we see our world, and how well are we interpreting it? So we start with the present, develop it, project it as possibilities into the future, not one big future, but multiple options. So this is not the root of the probable, but in a sense, the art of the possible. And there's a big difference between that, because these are optional futures, if you like. People can choose, they can respond, they can be value-based. And if design and creativity makes things visible and discussable, people can say what they feel about it. They can participate in that creation. And we include the past. So, this is a much more generous take on time, if you like. It's focused in the present, it accommodates the past, and it gives roots or possibilities into the future. And if you look at design as envisionment, there will always be more than one scenario. If you ask anyone to make anything in professional design terms, you will always have more than one idea. You will have a number of ideas. And I think the real question that we have is to judge the best sometimes. What criteria do you apply to judge the best? I'd like to propose, instead of creative futures, creative presents. It's almost Christmas. Seems fitting. Creative presents. How many different ways can you see what is going on around you? How many different ways? And what can you do yourself or in working with others that help you see our world, our context and situation from multiple and different points of view? A scientific, a technological, a sociological, a business, a creative, an arts-based, a community-based. So how well can that be articulated so that we have a very, very rich sense and not a mundane sense of how wealthy, in creative terms, the present is? And we start and we work with the present. So that, when I do my own work, whether it's in industry or in research, I would say what I have to try and do for myself and with others is to really see the world, really see the problem that is being described or the opportunity that is given. And from there we will get our inspiration. So, here we start looking at the tools I described earlier. Real people. We don't need to create user personas or fictional people or market segments. We don't need to do that exclusively. We can look at what goes on in people's homes. If we're studying the smart home or the home of the future, these pictures were taken by people in their own homes, having been given cultural probes, the name for designed tools, to narrate their own life. So this is a tool developed at the Royal College of Art by Tony Dunn and Bill Gaver. And there can be multiple versions, all different types of tools, but it's basically things given to people to allow them to document, to describe their own life, and to give that back to whoever the design team is and to use that as input. So these photographs that you're seeing here are what was developed, having been given disposable cameras. So this is what we got back. So this is what an actual home looks like for somebody. And it doesn't look much like the smart home I showed you earlier. Lots of animals in the pictures we got back. Pets. Many, many photographs of pets in homes. It's fantastic, isn't it? Collections. There's the other thing. Here's the stuff. The Economist wrote the article in praise of clutter. Do you remember the idea of the paperless office? which looked a bit like the smart home, where it was clean. Clean desk policy, we've heard about those. The Economist supported some research that was going on to say we spatially organise our lives. We organise our kitchen, we organise our desks, we're pilers or filers. That's how we are, but we need the stuff around us. We need it there. It's how we psychologically locate and organise what we're doing. So here in the home, it works exactly the same. There are collections of things for all kinds of reasons that we have. In the attic, in the cellar, under the bed, in the shed, all round the house, in every cupboard, and so on. So, another of the documented photographs from a Friday night somewhere in London. India. I took this photograph when I was in India doing some cultural research because of the what I was interested in was in a market like this, the numbers of people and the elegance of the women that had these little pyramids of lemons in their hand and a basket of lemons on their heads in that amount of people. So it was like the equivalent of the rush hour somewhere with all of these people milling around. So really trying to look and see behavioural patterns and how shopping is done. So it's not a stall, it's people moving around offering fruit in this kind of way. So also in India, religious iconography, these are in the rickshaws locally, the pictures of the gods, for example. Bollywood, it's now an international phenomenon, it's not just Indian. So again, how does this pan out in our society? So these are real people in real places. Here's a design studio. No students in it at this point. This is typically a studio as it would look, a workplace, a real workplace for doing interaction design, design for technology. And in that, there would be loads of clutter. There would be electronics, there would be toys, there would be soldering irons, there would be all kinds of stuff as part of the process of making. So it's not just a computer with a clean desktop. So these pictures are from the studio, interaction design studio at the Royal College of Art when I was there. So toy making workshop in this case. So these are the props and things that are used to make new things, the synthesis that I talked about earlier, the creative synthesis, real places. And the other one that's very interesting is real time. Here's Plockton in Scotland, on a day not unlike this in Glasgow. Here is technology, the technology of the telephone. And for somebody like myself, who works a lot in the areas of technology for internet and so on, we don't forget, and all of us need not forget, that not all technology is developing at the same rate. Cultures are not only multicultural, but they're multi-historical. There are different rates of change in different places for different reasons. So again, the mundane imagination says, our society is speeding up, it's 24/7, it's information society, and so on and so on and so on. But the answer to that is, no, not all the time for everybody. So even for all of us that might have technology in the workplace or in our home and we use mobile phones, we're not literally doing that 24 hours a day. Sometimes you sleep, sometimes you're out for a walk, sometimes you're doing other things. So you are also living, you could say, different time zones, almost different histories. And I think it's quite important that when we're designing for new things in the future, we know which history we're addressing. Because we could do something in Plockton, but it may not be the best idea to just bring in 21st century technology, although they have it there for other reasons in other places, and just think that that is necessarily a good thing. So we look at the cultures and we look at the histories, and we look at the passage of time in the day when you want to answer all of the emails in your inbox, when you want to answer your mobile phone, and the other times that you don't, because you're doing something else and you don't want to be distracted. And that's how we can design, to use the word, our days. So I put these up, and this is from where my parents live in the Highlands, so it's not so far removed. This is today, that there are slower cycles of transportation. There are slower cycles of technological implementation for very, very good reasons. A student project, Murat Koner, designed this tool to again ask people to narrate their own lives. He gave them red and green stickers and said, put in your history of significant things in any way that you like. And I think it was very, very clever, because basically what he did was he allowed them on the timeline, which is how everybody interpreted it, of course, to decide where today was. Where are we in our lives? How could they possibly put a dot on that line that said now? It's quite interesting. How big a past do they have? How generous a future did they give themselves? So this, in fact, opened up really a lot of questions about how we visualize and interpret and see and feel and experience our own lives. This is a simple one. Division up into a certain number of days. Here's another one. Today, tomorrow, the future. A completely different story on priorities and how the days would be filled. You can see the patterning of time in this. It's almost like a choreography, which I'll come back to later. It's like a musical score. Time is being designed like a musical score using these tools. Imagine if your diary looked like this. There's no reason why it looks the way it is today with our visualizations of time. This is a different kind of diary. This one has been filled in Hungary, and I think one of his parents filled this one in. So here you can just see narration of a lifeline or a lifetime. Today and tomorrow, somebody said, two divisions. And if you line them all up, and there were many more than I've shown you here, you see a kind of choreography of days and how people use and interpret time. So I'm simply showing you this to say this is a design tool that helps us look at how people spend time, how they experience time, in which case we can design for that, rather than the linear progressive model that our diaries seem to use. So here's a few things that I've covered, I think, in different ways. In terms of perception and ways of seeing, tools can be designed to help us see. The primary imagination, we need to be able to see, and we can design tools for ourselves or others to help us see. So narratives, cultural probes I talked about, photography. The minute you use a camera and put it in front of your eye, you are actively seeing. It is one of the great boon and blessings of using a camera, because you are literally, in a sense, switched on to look at the world in a different way. If I ask somebody to draw something, you are really actively looking. So again, it's these ways of really active perception that we're dealing with here. Meta design processes. Meta design processes means ways of participatory design, people documenting their own lives, working with us, together in collectives, whatever it takes, with technologists, business people, or university researchers, to work together to describe the place that we're looking at and then where it can be moved to. The design process itself is designed to fit the context. So although we have and can describe generic stages, observation and understanding, conceptual design, detailed design, prototyping, implementation, that typically those all occur simultaneously, and we can design to fit the situation. You might need to front load more in one aspect or another and balance them out in different ways. So the thing that I'm interested in those processes is the development of a collective intelligence between all of the people that are working together as a team, including the users, the community as participants, to develop a collective intelligence about the present and the potential futures, the possible futures that could be created. So, I'll just show you one or two things. My area is information technology mapped onto the, if you like, mapped onto the physical. So the virtual onto the physical, the intangible onto the intangible, the mobile phone, you can't see the system, but it's in the air. Internet, we all use it, but we can't see it. So how do we design systems for things that we can't see? Is my question as a designer. So here's an example, Indri Tulusan, who I worked with at Philips and who won a prize at the RCA for a community project, and this was it, Objects Lost, Unfound. And basically she proposed a system where objects that were being thrown out onto the street could be tagged and found and used by other people. So that sustainability was built in. If you were looking for something, you could find it through a connected system that used quite simple technologies to do this. So this is her proposal for tagging objects as you walk around in the environment and putting them into a circulation of potentially reusable objects. And the thing that she added into this was she added narratives to it. So the person that was throwing it out would say why they were getting rid of it. So there was a little narrative attached to each object. So there was a kind of playfulness, in fact, in investigating what all of this stuff was that was being thrown out and why it was being thrown out. It's quite intriguing to look at these things and find out the history, the biography, if you like, of the object was being tagged onto the object. So this is quite a simple system that could implement that. Living memory is the next one I'm going to show you. I mentioned earlier that I coordinated the European Commission's Connected Community Programme, which ran for about 3 or 4 years. And basically it started off, this is in Dutch, but the same things happen here in Scotland. Cats do get lost. I collected in the area that I lived in Utrecht, in Holland, informal publications. Anything that anybody put up in the local supermarket, the little cards that were handwritten, or the things like this that came through my door that had been created informally. And most computer systems are set up to deal with formal communications. And I was interested in how they could deal with informal communications, stuff like this. So I collected it all over a period of months. All of these kinds of posters, things that went up in Albert Heijn supermarket, or Tesco's here, the equivalent of those little cards, the things that go into newsagents' doors, all of those sorts of objects. And from that, I looked at how people then communicated between themselves. So if a lost cat page describing such a thing came through my door or a neighbour's, if I had seen it, I would phone that number and tell them, I saw your cat at 5 o'clock, it was in my back garden. And through that very informal, short connection, a social relationship has been initiated. That's all, we don't need to build in it anymore, but it has been, there is contact in the local environment between people that were not in contact before. And I analysed the media that had been used to make these things possible. So of course the photocopying machine, the fact that people circulate them around the environment, the phone calls, the answering machines and so on. And I wondered what could happen is if we used or designed technologies better, that as soon as the cat was lost, we could effectively, technologically, shout down 100 metres into the surrounding area. So why can't we do that? Why can't we say, I've lost my cat, press a button, and it goes to all of the houses in some media, to the whole community, in one go, rather than the photocopying route? So if you ask a simple question like that, it poses quite a big technological challenge to actually realise it. So the cat becomes, I call this the cat as catalyst. The cat became the catalyst for people to be able to talk to one another. And if you study communication, you'll come across the term social navigation. And you'll find that people need reasons to talk to one another. So if you go to your local park, again to use an animal metaphor, and somebody's got a dog like your dog, you might start to speak to them. You've got a reason to talk. but it's very difficult to walk up and start talking to a complete stranger. It's probably going to be perceived as threatening. So we need to mediate relationships between people in ways that they find appealing, interesting, and attractive. And these are the kinds of things that help that process. So, social navigation. Another example that I would use would be, I mentioned I lived in Utrecht for many years. If you wanted to come to Utrecht to have, let's say, an Italian meal, you could look up Digital City Utrecht, you could go onto the web, or if you knew me, you could phone me. And I would give you the best information about Italian restaurants in Utrecht. And most up-to-date, perhaps. And if you know me, you would be able to say to yourself, if Irene likes it, I'll probably like it. If Irene likes it, I probably won't like it. So that's how we socially navigate and make up our minds about things, depending on who we hear it from. And of course, newspapers and publishing work on the same thing. You buy into a trusted opinion. So, the CAT is Catalyst, bringing people together. So here's Connected Community. We focused on local needs, informal communication, and shared memory and experience. Some of these terms I've already defined. Participatory design, augmented reality, meaning bringing technology into the physical space, making it understandable and usable. Community is database. I would use a different term now. I would use the term, everybody's an expert. So if we knew the people that lived in the local community, like retired teachers, somebody who'd be willing to do shopping or gardening, if we could access the full potential of human resources in the workplace or in the community, we would be very wealthy, inverted commas, in terms of resource. But we can't because of communication problems and because we don't know the potential that's round about us. So I was not interested in accessing data, I was interested in accessing people. Territory as interface just means we could use any spot in the territory. So here it was, this is what went to the European Commission. The Lost Cat generated all of this, and it started a program that ran across Europe with about maybe 30 institutions for 3 years, running different projects, looking at some of these challenges, which all came out of just looking, the perception, the seeing of how things were and possibly how they could be improved. Set up a reference group, if you like, a cultural board that would help us think about memory, community, and communication. And then this is a very fast cut to 3 years later, because these are some of the prototypes that were placed in pubs, shopping malls, schools in Edinburgh. One of the partners was in Edinburgh. I was in Holland. We worked with Domus Academy and Imperial College in London and Philips Design and Philips Technology Research Labs. And the user research, the ethnography research went on in Edinburgh. So the prototypes came to Edinburgh. So what you see here is a display, and basically inside it are all of the little cards that you might have seen in the newsagent shop. And you could simply whirl them around at any speed you liked. And if you were interested in one of them, you pushed it forward and it opened up. If you were really interested in it, you pushed it further forward and it went into that tray and you took one of the tokens and it had that information on it. So that token only had the bit you needed. This is physical computing, tangible computing, that you only need to have what you need at any point in time. So these are very simple examples of how technology can be developed from using those first ideas about Lost Cat. So these are just some of the visuals, the user research and the feedback that went on in Edinburgh. Similar project, cross-cultural with children in Italy and in Belgium, again using tools and props to communicate with each other because of course they're speaking different languages, so they're doing it visually. So they're creating a little virtual world to tell stories. Same principles that are involved, and we're working on a community level and not an individual level. So like to show you some of the work going on at the Glasgow School of Art with one of my colleagues. And this is looking at design intervention in terms of the health service and medical practice, we could say. So here you see the pathway, the complete pathway, as seen from a clinician's point of view, of someone who has had a stroke. And you'll see in this the division into independent or dependent living. Now, the first interesting thing about this as a visual is that it is connecting up the whole process of what happens to someone when they have had a stroke. So it's not the single view, the single instance, the single place as an outpatient, an inpatient, an operation, but the story of that. And if that is connected up, you can add in, as part of that story, what we could call the design interventions. So here are the design interventions that could improve that pathway, that experience through that. And then working with the clinicians, the health service management patients, different interpretations and pathways can be viewed and created. So here is visual modelling based on how do you see the health service working and from whose point of view. So this is the work of Professor Alistair MacDonald at the Glasgow School of Art, who's an expert in inclusive design and has done this research together with clinicians at Glasgow University. So this is Alistair here. And then we have some of the people at Glasgow University, the head of women's health, the head of geriatrics, the head of undergraduate medicine, and a human factors specialist, looking at these mappings in order to improve the quality of the experience. So, to kind of round up, because I've just got 2 or 3 minutes, I think, these are the things I've talked about tonight as part of this overview. So design as using visual language, making ideas and thinking visible. That's what I started off with tonight. Tangible, visible thinking. And all of these and many more are ways of doing that. So we place, and we, anybody involved as part of a team, and that's not just the designers, but if there is a design process involved, there is a high value placed on communication and participation. Action-based research. So we act and we intervene. The choreography, this is how a design process works in my view, and I'm just going to really skip through this, but it's quite simple. We look at people, we look at cultural context, we look at technology as an affordance, as an enabler, and we look at design. And when I say design in this way, I mean the profession of design. Graphic design, product design engineering, somebody with an honours degree or whatever. So this is the professional level of design training and education, and the practitioners. And then the idea is you do a project and somebody expects at some point to have 100% result. You're going to design a new car, you're going to improve the health service, we're going to make a poster, whatever it is. It has to be realised. The 100% is kind of implicit. We have to finish what we start. But the way that I propose is I propose something that I call 1% design. And that just means you start with all of this on day one, immediately, in the present, and you start designing. Action-based research. So even if you only have 1% information, it is possible to do 1% design. If you have 1% inkling of what your technology direction is, you can accommodate that, you can use it. Because as soon as you do that 1% and make it visible, you get feedback. So the quality improves and the risk decreases. So at any point you can stop and say, it's 10%, it's 20%, we iterate, then we go back and we look at it, we prototype, we get feedback and so on. So here's the 1% design, and the reason this band is in pink is that design is increasing. Design or designers are increasingly used in processes in which they are the facilitators of creative thinking. So on one level they are a profession, on another level they are very good at bringing different kinds of knowledges together and synthesizing from it. Because to make a mobile phone, you have to be able to know about technology, cultural research, form, interaction and behavior, but you have to make something, you have to synthesize it and put all of that together and make something that looks attractive enough for somebody to want to have, for example. So this is synthesis across a whole process. And we pull it together in workshops where there are outputs. Typically there are phases in a design process where you really pull it all together. Pull everyone around the table and create an output. Create something that is visible, even if it's 1%. So the model that I use is DNA. I sometimes talk about the DNA model of design because it looks a bit like that. So divergence, convergence, looks a bit like this. In all of the disciplines, we need to research and then we need to apply. And here's another visual metaphor for it, a little bit closer to home. So here's the design process. If you apply that principle all the way through, there can be outputs all the way through and there can be iteration. Choreography, you could say. Scoring, like my timelines, is a visual metaphor for this. So to summarize, I've presented the difference, I hope, between mundane futures, which look a little bit like this, researching the probable, what everybody agrees about, creating more information, doing more research in order to research, and in distinction to that, I say no, we act in the present by observing the present and acting within it to do something and to create something that others can respond to and share. So here's creative presence, the summary, the art of the possible, multiple views, spirit of exploration, let's not be too worried about all of this, let's try, let's get cracking on, using your background knowledge and expertise immediately. We don't have to research more to do research. So it really is trying to move into that kind of space. So, in summarising, community design, technology and well-being, primary imagination and secondary imagination, doing things together. And there's a reference for what we could create, tools that Ivan Illich calls tools for conviviality. This is design for community. So as a last word, I'd like to say that Glasgow School of Art is collaborating at the moment with Glasgow University and Strathclyde University and Scottish Enterprise and other partners to set up a centre for what has been called social innovation. I've called it sociable innovation, in order to apply some of this thinking and to share it between business, technology, philosophy, psychology, art and design. And to say, right, in Glasgow, in Scotland, we can do these kinds of things, and many of us already are. So again, respecting what's been done in the past, including what is going on in the present, but starting with the 1%. So we are starting this now. And so for anybody that wants to be included in this, you can talk to myself afterwards, if you like, or you can email me. My colleague Alistair is already here. I mentioned his work earlier. And Amanda Cockcroft is also here, and you can talk to one of us about it. But this is a way for all of us to perhaps collaborate in exploring some of this thinking. So back to my original picture, and I hope I've been able to say something about looking at community as the value-based starting position rather than globalization or individual. I look at community as the group factor. Designing on the base of value, create the vision, and then enter the venture of the project of the 1% that will lead us up to the 100% through that kind of iteration that I've described. So I think I'll stop there. I hope you've enjoyed it, and thank you very much for your attention.
thank you very much for such a generous bunch of language to think with. I loved it. Thank you very much indeed. I would like to open the floor to some questions or other discussion that you might like to initiate at this point, and then in about 10 minutes or 15 we'll have a little session that has to do with formulating some topics for the end of January, when we hope to get back together with Irene and talk about some of the things that the center might be doing and that you might all do together. So is there anyone that would like to jump in with a question or statement based on this lecture? Well, let's see. I've got one somewhere. Yes, sir.
Yes.
I feel I like your idea of that everyone's an expert and working in restoring communities, working in deprived areas. And really sort of caught my imagination if we could communicate with everybody and find out what they're all good at and use that. I mean, it's sort of engaging them and really developing what this community wants to see itself doing.
I think it's quite interesting because it's an unexplored resource to try and do that. And it struck me when I was doing that research project on connected community that we were trying to advertise on the web for resources for teachers, for example, to help children with their homework. And there were the retired teachers around the corner that could have helped. So it's just really valuing the human resource and trying to find ways to find out then becomes the question. Yeah. I think there was somebody else up here, was there? Or no? Yes.
In terms of developing your thoughts and your ideas, and when you look apply them in a particular situation, do you find that there's certain times when the time is right? You can apply this at a certain time and it doesn't work, at other times it works very, very well. And in the same way, can you say that in certain places you can apply this at certain times, but not in others? Are there certain places that where this approach works better than in others? And in those places, does that vary according to time?
Right.
So that.
Yeah. Well, I can only talk about, of course, my own experience, so I can't give you a kind of generic answer, but I would say that this can apply most of the time, and the reason that I'm quite confident in saying that is that it allows people to act. And there is a tendency in many organisations, business, government institutions, many, many places, of almost being slightly frightened of making a move. And sometimes there is a tendency to ask for more research before the move is made. And that can lead to a situation that I've described elsewhere as what I call informational obesity. And I think that many organisations suffer from that, that they commission more and more research and thinking, think tank thinking. And what this is all about is doing. And there's a great release in doing something which is non-threatening, because we're only asking to try to do something together and it's 1%. So it's very generously saying we're not coming in and trying to solve 100% problem. We hope we will eventually. But the mechanism by which we're doing that is to allow the people who are motivated, that would be a condition, who have an intention to participate, can sit around the table and can decide to try to do something together. And the fact that it doesn't work immediately is not such a problem, because tomorrow you do the 2%. So it takes out, I think, it gives a different mentality and approach, which means that many of the difficulties in collaboration or the context are just eased up quite a lot. And also giving people the confidence that they're using their background knowledge immediately rather than having to do 6 months research before they can act. So all of those those things are tactics that are typically the opposite or can be the opposite of what tends to happen or what could happen. And so it's quite refreshing, and it's very valuable to see evidence of work quickly.
One of the nice anchors for me is that when you talk about connected community and inclusive community, what you're doing is helping us be led down a path of collaboration that isn't about design or about creativity, the kinds of things that sometimes people are quite afraid of thinking, well, do I have any or can I do that or something like that. So if you find those sort of value streams that become shared goals, they become the maker of the process without much, without having to have a particular environment for it. Just a kind of willingness to
enter into it.
Yeah.
So that's why I used words like improvisation and the spirit of improvisation, the spirit of exploration, rather than the fully defined project that even knows its outputs before it's started. So it's just, I suppose, a little bit of an antidote as well.
There's a lovely book that is called Hopping Home Backwards, which is written by a dancer who talks about the fact that from the moment a child is born, we're absolutely trying to get them to stop expressing themselves, stop moving, stop screaming, stop crawling that way. It's all, you're doing all of that wrong. There's a way to move through the world, and you're doing it wrong. You've got to sit up straight, you've got to be quiet, all these things. And I think that part of what you're talking about is kind of re-releasing the genie in the bottle that we were born with, and rediscovering how you can connect your own creativity with what you do, because we all have it. It's in the last century we got quite smitten with putting things in boxes and silos, didn't we? And it's the time that's all just now doesn't make sense, but we don't quite know how to work in that.
Maybe one of the things that I would add to both of the points made already. Can you hear me? Yeah. Is that I would say it, maybe this is putting it too extreme, but it almost doesn't matter what a group does together, as long as they do something. Mm-hmm. So the doing something together actually facilitates the rest. So the creative process, it could be a problem that needs to be solved, an issue that is pertinent, or they could get together to discover what that issue could be. What could they do together? But in a sense, it's the cat, it's the catalyst that is acting. The project is the catalyst. You see what I mean? So we need the reasons to get together. So we have to give people projects that allow them to collaborate and to act communally.
Martin.
Hi. Firstly, I really like the process. I like that idea of deliberating that idea of being able to explore and be practical at the same time. It's very fresh air to be able to come off the abstract theoretical stuff that people get bogged down in. I'm interested in the two aspects. How do you draw people together? How do you invite them in? And then how do you choose the project or the issue or the opportunity?
Mm-hmm.
So those are practical methods of basically the who and the what.
Mm-hmm. Where are you?
Periscope.
Yes, that's right. It depends on the context. I think that sometimes, in terms of social innovation, I think that things can be done locally in a community by just asking, almost like putting up the ticket in the newsagents and saying, today we're going to talk about waste and litter in the community. The streets are a mess. Anybody interested in talking about that? What do you think about it? Come along and talk to us for an hour. And in that hour, we're going to try and see if there's a way of solving such a problem. We'll come up with a few ideas. And basically, if we can come up with one or two ideas, we're going to decide to implement them tomorrow. So it's again the same spirit. So I think the recruitment, if you like, process would depend. In the example of Alistair's, in terms of the medical, the health service, and being able to intervene in design terms, you could say, with a group there, then obviously there are some other mechanisms to be gone through because the environment is quite different. But I think that it's always best in these kinds of processes to work with people who are motivated to do so. And that does not necessarily mean positive motivation, it means energy. So not everybody has to agree, but they have to be willing to participate. Yeah.
Yes, sir.
I mean, could I just ask if you could say something a bit more on what you mean by community here? I mean, is this something that this process has been done to? Is it something that the community starts itself, or is the community the whole design process?
Creative communities can be used in two senses for me. Some people use it to apply to the professional creative community, like the creative industries. The way that I'm using it, and in terms of community, is in a wider sense. So I use the word community to describe people who can identify having a shared relationship. So they may not necessarily all like each other again or get on, but they identify that they have a shared relationship. So a community could be a workforce, and it's a very good place to study community, I found, because it's a group of people working together who have a shared relationship because of a common goal in an organisation of some sort. And they don't necessarily all get on, but it is an environment in which we have to collaborate for the enterprise, whatever it is, to succeed. And that's why I find the work environment very, very fascinating. So I tend to look at diverse communities rather than communities of interest. So all of the people who are involved in online interest groups, that is not my area of research. I look for diverse populations, but who can recognise one another as sharing some relationship, and it could just be the place they live, the organisation they work for, something like that. So that's community in a very generous sense in which I'm using it. Does that answer your question?
Can I just ask one more? Does the need for design, is this something that the community has generated, or is this something
I don't think anybody need formally say we need design. I think that in many aspects of life we need creative solutions. And so that's why I use the phrase creative communities. And the processes that I'm describing is helping people to identify, to see, and to recognise and act on their own problems, rather than have some other expert come in and solve it for them. Because that's the most empowering thing, to be able to see, accept, and recognise the problem. That's the 1% in a sense. And to be able to collectively act on it towards solution. So that's a very energetic situation. So it's totally the opposite from somebody, whether it's a designer or somebody else, coming in to research the community and say, I think we need this, and I'll come back with it next week, and here you go. So that would be the opposite that I'm not proposing. So the first one is, it could be generated from people from the outside. It doesn't really matter so much, as long as people are collectively willing to engage in a process.
Do you see this as a new way of thinking or a new approach to design, or do you think it's a reaction to the fact that the sort of acceleration of technology has left certain people who previously would have been actively involved in sort of functional items within the community, but now because of technology is in a sense they just enfranchise a lot of people, so in that way it's been pulling them back into the decision making process again?
Yeah. exactly. I think that it's it is looking at design again as a, through a, this different lens. So I divide, or one way of thinking about design is in different sensibilities: the craft sensibility, the artifact product sensibility, the interactional sensibility, which is the interaction design, the technology, and the transformational sensibility. And the last one has been what I'm talking about: the transformational sensibility that can help people transform their own circumstance. Because if you think about design and using design in the most generous sense, in the way that I describe the mundane and creative imagination, we all design our own lives. And the trouble with a lot of problems in life is that we think we only have one option. And what at least a design training teaches people, and very clearly from the start, is that there are always multiple options. Always. You have to generate more than one solution. And if you do that, you're giving people, that's why I say that this kind of thinking gives people the power to even know and realize that there is more than one line to the future, there is more than one probability, that there are other things that could perhaps happen. And that's exactly as you described, that's the empowering thing. So it is still the design process, but it is being used in an arena that is about human value and human resource much more strongly, if you like, much more actively in that space.
Yes.
Health Scotland. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I've seen the research, yeah. Yeah, I mean, something like that. Or I've been discussing with the Beetson Oncology Centre, my original work all of those years ago that I told you about at the beginning was in cancer research, and I'm quite interested to bring some of these ways of thinking into some of the, you could say, extreme environments in hospitals as well, and to look at people as more than the patient. So it's exactly the comment, if everybody's an expert, what could they be doing in hospital when they're not just a patient? Is actually a very, I mean, just to have that thought, and I thought, oh, there's all of these people kind of sitting about or lying about or watching television, and there could be this wealth of human resource in these places that we call hospitals. So I'm talking to the Beetson to look at creative community within the new Gartnavel, the oncology centre there, to explore that as an idea. So yes, indeed, in those places we can apply the same thinking. It's good. What I'm saying is there are many contexts, and I think in all of our work, including the so-called traditional design areas, then this sensibility can be applied.
One last one, and then we're going to do a little bit of 5 minutes of work, and then we get a glass of wine.
Oh, a reward. Well, even those organisations can fund a 1%. It's usually very simple in my experience, for organisations to be able to write cheques for smaller amounts of money. And so maybe they should write a few checks that allows them to participate in design workshops with this kind of sensibility and discover, you know, come on in, the water's lovely, and discover that that kind of thinking, that the 1% work together with those architects, exploring radical innovation, which will make sense. In business terms, that's what we did in Philips. We explored radical innovation because it makes sense in terms of enterprise. That maybe it's a learning process to find out that those options can in fact be engaged with. But the start point is, I think, the participation of people in different types of organisations in those creative processes in order to generate and accept the generation of different kinds of outputs. And in the European Commission projects I told you about, that was written into it, that we would engage with not only technologists, business people and so on, but policy makers. So that's government. And I think that there is an appetite today, I sense, I feel, I can't give you evidence, for people to engage much more with action-based, action research, doing things rather than more of the structured, talking, informational research processes. So perhaps the offer can be to try it and to do a little of it, and then to ask those people how they can translate these processes back into their organisation creatively, because they have to operate creatively themselves. And maybe that should be a demand from the public. They should be demand-driven.
So I'm happy to find out what some of these demands are. Your first creative present for this evening, besides the one we've already had, which has been fantastic, is to, I want everybody, just this literally will be 1 minute, just to close your eyes and listen to the wind, because we're bound to get some, and listen to what would you think if you were going to a sociable inclusion center? What would you think needs to be worked on in Glasgow? Something very local or something for the whole city? And then when you hear the bell, I want you to find someone and together, just one other person, write the card that goes on the bulletin board at the Social Inclusion Center, because everyone's going to be coming there to see what groups are going to get together. So, first 1 minute of nice silence, that's your first Christmas present. Creative present. The second will be for our presents, will be to get some ideas of postcards. And that will form the basis of some of the things we talk about on the 31st in the follow-up.
Yeah, workshop. That's a good idea.
Okay, so yeah. Eyes shut, 1 minute. Find someone and meld your two ideas into one bulletin board message. You got about 2 minutes. No longer.
That's a great idea. That is a fantastic start, actually. What a brilliant idea you've had, because then I can seed it all with these feedbacks. No, I think they're all milling around.
Yeah. Give him 2 minutes and then...
see if anybody wants to share. I hope they're still recording.
It's good. I'll add them into my list as they come up. I said it to Andrew as well. That's why it's only a recording, because some of the images are from Philips and so on, and so they're. I can use them for educational purposes, but that's it. I can't distribute them.
I can use them. We'll call a halt to the whole thing, so not everybody will get a chance, but we all want them on paper. Who's got a notice for the
one
corner store?
Yeah.
For the Sociable Inclusion Center bulletin board.
Exactly. And have you got anything?
Come on, I saw some people writing. Come on, I saw you writing.
Okay. It's just an issue to take forward, something that you think might be worthwhile pursuing.
What do we need to work on in Glasgow?
Yeah. Yes. Who's that?
Yes,
Andrew. Yes. Oh, right. Yes.
Yes.
Domestic violence.
Domestic violence.
Good one.
You can look at it much further upstream to try and think whatever happened in the first place.
Right.
And that involves children and adults together.
Great one.
Yeah.
Andrew, another one.
Yeah. This is my question. The other day, I was talking about quite a few questions. Was about this. I'm eight. There's a thing for, as I said, for social innovation. But my question would be something like, you know, why do so many people in Glasgow still have to live in poverty? Would be my question.
Have to?
Live in poverty.
How many? What? Yeah.
Why?
Alistair.
We had food and exercise and words. Social behaviour on the other side. I suppose I have a question for you about that. What can food and exercise do for social behaviour?
Exercise and
the exercise of social behaviour.
Putting them together. Exercise and
exercise.
What can they do for each other?
Oh, right. And see social behaviour. Okay.
Who's got another one? There must be more problems in Glasgow. Yes, Pete.
How do we break that cycle of material desires?
Material society, break the cycle. Where are you? Yes, just behind Andrew, and then here.
Yes, because it's basically just keep your pocket. I'm not going to live in all these flats.
Who's going to live in all these flats? That's a very good one. Yes, sir.
How do we make getting drunk not all right?
How do we make getting drunk not all right? Absolutely. Any more? Yes, sir, in the back.
Is Glasgow sustainable?
Is Glasgow sustainable? And on that happy note, any others?
Oh, that's a good one.
Yes, sir.
Just one of the people here, you're all for the workers. We're saying, can we think about dignity for the workers, especially for the line workers, in some of these difficult services and difficult environments?
Mm-hmm.
Especially night workers.
Did you say?
Is this what you said?
It's just on your mind.
What?
Frontline workers, not night.
Including night workers.
They're on our minds. Yes, ma'am.
How do we break the gender stereotypes that limit possible futures of men and of women?
Right. Breakdown.